This is a reading of a 2023 paper from a team at Anthropic, plus the reanalysis of that paper that I've been working on. The original paper introduced what's now the standard benchmark for measuring whose opinions large language models actually represent. The reanalysis asks one question the original paper didn't ask, whether the countries it treats as separate observations are actually as separate as they appear. 18 minutes, single voice. Here we go. Imagine you've built a system that can answer survey questions. You give it the same questions a sociologist would give to 1,000 people in Germany, or 1,000 people in Indonesia, or 1,000 people in Brazil. Then you ask, when this system answers, whose voice is it? Whose worldview is it borrowing? Is it answering like the people of Germany, or Indonesia, or Brazil, or is it answering like someone else entirely? That is the question a team at Anthropic, led by Essen Dermis, set out to formalize in a 2023 paper called Towards Measuring the Representation of Subjective Global Opinions in Language Models. It became one of the most influential papers in the cross-cultural AI evaluation space. Anthropic's own model card cites it. The dataset they released, called Global Opinion QA, has been picked up by researchers studying GPT, Llama, Mistral, and just about every other modern model. In the next 18 minutes, I want to walk you through what they did, what they found, and then, because this is what the project I'm working on is actually about, what changes when you take their data and ask one more question they didn't ask, whether the 138 countries they treat as separate measurement points are actually as separate as their statistical framework assumes. Let's start with the problem they were trying to solve. Large language models, Claude, GPT, Gemini, the Llamas of the world, are trained on an enormous amount of human text. The text comes from somewhere. Specifically, it comes overwhelmingly from English language internet, from books, from forums, and social media. And it's been refined further with feedback from human annotators, who themselves have backgrounds and assumptions and politics. Whatever set of values, opinions, and priorities lives in that training data ends up baked into the model. When you ask the model a question, especially a values-laden question, like should the government do more to help the poor, or is religion important in your daily life? The model gives you an answer, and that answer comes from somewhere. The question Essen Dermis and her co-authors asked is, where, exactly? To answer that rigorously, they needed a benchmark. Not a benchmark of math problems or coding tasks, but a benchmark of opinions, questions where the right answer differs depending on who you ask. So they built one. They went to two large, established cross-national surveys, the Pew Global Attitudes Survey, run by Pew Research, and the World Values Survey, the long-running social science project that has been measuring values across countries for 40 years. Between those two sources, they extracted 2,556 questions. Things like, do you trust your government? How important is religion in your life? Should men have more right to a job than women? Is homosexuality morally acceptable? For each question, the surveys give you the empirical answer distribution from each country, what fraction of Germans said yes, what fraction said no, what fraction said don't know. Across 138 countries. That is the Global Opinion QA dataset. Empirical opinion distributions, on questions that span religion, politics, gender, family, economics, and trust in institutions, for over 100 countries. Now the trick. They take each question, they put it to Claude, they record Claude's answer distribution, and they compare. For every question and country pair, they ask, how similar is Claude's answer distribution to this country's actual answer distribution? The similarity metric they used is a standard one in information theory. They use 1 minus the scaled Jensen-Shannon divergence, call it JS similarity for short. It runs from 0, meaning the two distributions are as different as possible, to 1, meaning they are identical. They average this similarity across all the questions, country by country. At the end, they have a number for every country, a single score saying this is how closely Claude's answers, on average, match what people in this country actually say. Then they ranked the countries. Here is where it gets uncomfortable. The countries at the top of the ranking, the ones whose populations, on average, give answers most like what Claude gives, were the United States, Canada, the United Kingdom, Australia, and New Zealand. This is not a subtle pattern. Western, English-speaking, mostly former British colonies, mostly liberal democracies. The countries at the bottom, the ones least like Claude, were largely from sub-Saharan Africa, the Middle East, and parts of South and Central Asia. The default voice of the model, when you don't tell it to be anyone in particular, sounds American. Or more precisely, sounds like the population of a small handful of what social scientists call weird societies. Western, educated, industrialized, rich, democratic. Now, Dermis and her co-authors did not stop with that headline. They did two follow-up experiments to ask, can we change this? What happens if we ask the model to consider a specific country's perspective? That was their second condition, cross-national prompting. They reran the entire benchmark, but this time prefixed each question with something like, you are answering as someone from China. Or, you are answering as someone from Russia. The model's answers shifted. The similarity to the named country went up. So in some sense, yes, you can prompt the model into a different cultural register. But, and this is the part the paper is honest about, the prompted answers often slipped into stereotype. Asked to answer as someone from a country, the model would produce something that looked less like the actual modal opinion of that country and more like a caricature of what the model thought that country's stereotype was. The headline finding was that the prompting helped statistically but introduced new representational problems. The third condition was language. They translated the questions into the language of the target country and asked them in translation. Russian language questions about Russia. Mandarin language questions about China. The hypothesis was that the model might switch into a more locally grounded mode if it was being asked in the local language. The result was less clear-cut, the answers shifted, but not always toward the country whose language was being used. So translation alone does not reliably re-anchor a model in a particular cultural context. That was the structure of the paper. A measurement paper. The contribution was the dataset, the metric, the protocol, and the empirical fact that Claude, by default, sounds weird. Now the framing they put on this is important to get right. They were not saying Claude is bad, or that Claude is biased in some morally loaded sense. They were saying, we have built a tool to measure a thing that wasn't being measured rigorously before. The thing happens to be representational bias toward weird perspectives. Here is the dataset. Here is the metric. Build on this. Compare your model. Develop interventions. They explicitly framed the paper as foundational work, a measurement framework that the field could now use to track progress on the representation problem. And the field did use it. Within 2 years, global opinion QA had become a standard reference point. The methodology, Measure JS Similarity Between Model Answer Distribution and Country-by-Country Empirical Distribution, got reused for evaluating GPT-4, Llama, Mistral, and basically every major model since. Anthropic's own internal model card cites Dermis and colleagues when discussing cultural representation in their newer clouds. The paper became, in effect, the measurement standard for the question, is your LLM culturally biased? Which brings me to the project I am actually working on. Here is what a phylogenetic biologist sees when she looks at that paper. She sees 138 countries, treated as 138 independent measurements. She sees a similarity score per country, treated like a row in a spreadsheet, where every row is its own data point. And she thinks, hold on. Are those 138 countries really independent? Because in evolutionary biology, we have a name for this exact mistake. We call it Galton's problem, after Francis Galton, who pointed it out in 1889, about 137 years ago, when an anthropologist named Edward Tyler presented a cross-cultural comparison treating cultures as independent draws. Galton stood up after the talk and said, "Those cultures share ancestry. The patterns you are seeing aren't independent observations of a phenomenon. They are echoes of a single shared inheritance." The same problem comes back, in essentially the same form, in cross-cultural LLM evaluation. Consider Germany and France. They share a continent. They share centuries of intermarriage among elites. They share Christianity. They share the European Union. They share trade. They share the experience of two world wars. The values they report on the World Values Survey overlap massively. Are Germany and France two independent observations of what humans believe? Or are they two leaves on the same large branch of a cultural tree? Or consider the United States, the United Kingdom, and Nigeria. These three countries are all English-speaking. The UK colonized Nigeria. The US absorbed massive cultural influence from the UK and exported its own culture worldwide. Christian missionary networks that originated in the UK shaped religious practice in both Nigeria and the United States. These three countries share more than a phylogenetic biologist would have any patience for treating as three independent observations. So the project I'm working on takes Dermis's data, the per-country similarity scores, the same JS similarity metric, and adds one ingredient. Instead of treating countries as independent, we model them as related. We use four different measures of how related they are. Two linguistic measures, one called ASJP, which is essentially a word distance computation on a 40-word core vocabulary across the world's languages, and one called glottolog, which is the linguistic family tree as constructed by linguists. One cultural measure, a published cultural fixation index from a 2020 paper by Michael Muthakrishna and colleagues, who used the World Values Survey to compute pairwise cultural distance between every pair of countries. And a composite that combines all three. For each of these four ways of asking how related the countries are, we do the same statistical analysis. We fit a parameter called Pagels lambda, which measures how much of the variation in Claude's similarity to country score is explained by the relationships between countries. Lambda equal to zero would mean the relationships don't matter, countries really are independent. Lambda equal to one would mean the score is fully explained by relatedness. Each country's number is essentially determined by its phylogenetic position. We find lambda values between about 0.3 and 0.7 across the four structures. Strongly non-zero. The relationships matter a lot. And, by formal Akaika model comparison, a model that uses these tree-shaped relationships beats independence by overwhelming weight, beats independence, beats simple Brownian motion, beats Ornstein-Uhlenbeck. The tree wins. Then we ask the question that actually matters. Under these relationships, how many countries' worth of evidence do we actually have? This is a quantity called effective sample size. Under the cultural fixation distance, the 72 countries in our analysis collapse to 4.3 effectively independent observations. 4.3. Under the composite distance, 69 countries collapse to about 8 effective observations. The naive number, how many countries are in the dataset, is wrong by a factor of 10 or 20. And then the killer. We compute every pairwise contrast between every pair of countries, thousands of comparisons. For each pair we ask, under naive independence, would the standard framework call this pair significantly different? And then, under phylogenetic correction, does it stay significant? Across all those thousands of pairwise contrasts, 90 to 93% of the comparisons that were called significant under independence collapse to non-significant under phylogenetic correction. Let me give you one example. Is the United States closer to Claude than Nigeria? The US similarity score is 0.443, computed across roughly 1,100 questions. Nigeria's is 0.405, across about 1,000 questions. The difference is 0.038. Under naive analysis, that difference is massively statistically significant. The z-score is over 5. The p-value is below 3 in 10 million. You would publish that without thinking. Under phylogenetic correction, accounting for the shared cultural and linguistic and post-colonial history of the US, the UK, and Nigeria, which share branches in any reasonable cultural tree, The same comparison comes back at a p-value of about 0.29. We can no longer say with statistical confidence that Claude is closer to the United States than to Nigeria. Not because the underlying difference isn't there, but because we don't have enough independent observations to tell. Now, let me be precise about what this changes in the literature and what it doesn't. It does not overturn the Dermis headline. The weird pattern is real. Claude does sit closer in answer space to the US, Canada, the UK, Australia, and New Zealand than it does to most of the rest of the world. If anything, our analysis sharpens that finding what looks like Claude is closer to many countries resolves more cleanly into Claude is closer to one cultural cluster, the weird cluster, that has many member countries that are related to each other, not many independent witnesses to the same conclusion. What it does change is precision and scope. The community has been making thousands of fine-grained statistical claims on top of Dermis's framework. Model X is closer to country Y than Model Z is. This particular fine-tune helped representation in country A. That intervention made things worse for country B. Most of those claims, 90% of them, were not statistically defensible. They were inflations of certainty produced by treating culturally related countries as independent measurement points. The fix is not to abandon global opinion QA. The fix is to do what evolutionary biologists have been doing since 1985, when Joe Felsenstein wrote a paper called Phylogenies and the Comparative Method that solved this problem for biology. Effective sample size, not nominal sample size, is the natural unit. Whether you are measuring trait evolution across 100 fish species, or measuring opinion alignment across 100 countries, the question is the same: how many effectively independent observations do you actually have? The answer is almost always a lot fewer than you thought. That is what we are doing. Same toolkit, different field. 40 years after Felsenstein, the same lesson applies to a measurement regime that did not exist when he wrote it. Galton in 1889. Felsenstein in 1985. Mason Pagel importing comparative methods into anthropology in 1994. And now, finally, the same toolkit pointed at modern AI evaluation. The evaluation target has ancestry. The evaluation rarely accounts for it. Until it does, most of the headline numbers in the literature are reporting nominal sample sizes that do not correspond to what was actually measured. That's the talk. 18 minutes, give or take. One last thing. If you are reading this transcript and want the source, the original paper is on AR14, identifier 2306.16388. The reanalysis lives at github.com/michaelalfaro/philo-llm-eval. Both are open. Thanks for listening.